All right, I would ask you if you would please to turn to the book of Exodus. And tonight we're going to look at the Exodus. Is that a coincidence or? No, probably not. Okay, so we come to the, obviously, the namesake of the book. And I had you go back to verse 37 of chapter 12. It's not really a part, you know, it's just a little hangover from chapter 12 that we wanted to look at. But the point that I wanted you to see is that in chapter 12, starting in verse 37, it says the people of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. Okay, so that probably means that roughly somewhere between 1.5 to 2.5 million people left. A very conservative number would be about 1.5 million if you count about 1.5 children per man leaving. You'd have roughly 1.5 million going out. If you have 2 to 3 children per, that number goes up dramatically. Okay, so that's a large number. And that's the idea. Moses is trying to say this is a great throng of people that are leaving Egypt at this time. It also says in the next verse that a mixed multitude also went up with them. And what that means is that there were probably other nations, other than just the Israelites, the Hebrews, who went with these people, cast their lot with the Hebrews, and left with them to go. So that number probably increases from the 600,000. So you could be looking at 3 million people walking out of here all at once. That's a huge crowd of people to go. Again, it is highly likely that the Egyptians, being the warlike people that they were at this time, had conquered a number of other peoples from around them, particularly from Canaan. And so it's very possible that there were a whole lot of native Canaanites who were enslaved in Egypt along with the Hebrews, and they wanted to go home too. And so they saw themselves as a way to leave as going with these Hebrews as they are leaving. In verse 40, it says that the time that the people of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of 430 years, and here's the key phrase, on that very day, all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. Now, it looks, at first glance, it looks as though what Moses is saying is that on the very day of exactly 430 years, the people left, okay? And certainly, that's one way to read that text, meaning that, okay, yes, at the very point that the people of Israel were, you know, at some point in the past, 430 years had elapsed on the very day of the anniversary of that. But the problem that we have is knowing the anniversary date to what? What exact date does this go back to? Does it go back to the days that Jacob entered into Egypt with his family? Or does it go back to a time of enslavement of some sort or to some other event? We're not exactly sure. So, and the other thing to keep in mind is that Hebrews were notorious about dealing with numbers rather improperly. I mean, they often rounded off or they used numbers in ways that were not consistent from time to time. If you read the genealogies, for example, sometimes the numbers don't add up, because they're not really trying to be perfect with them. It was not in the nature of ancient Hebrews to be like we are in the scientific age, very specific and exacting when it comes to numbers. So Moses may have been saying here one of two things. Either one, there was a specific anniversary that these Israelites walked into Egypt and they walked out on the 430th anniversary of that day, or a more likely scenario to me anyways, is that this had been a period of time that had been specifically known by God, as remember he had said to Abraham, and thus the people were leaving when God said it was going to happen. Whether that's exactly the same day or not, it's hard to say. The underlying Hebrew under that phrase, on the very day, doesn't have to be translated exactly that way. So we don't really know. What we do know is this. No matter how you translate it, and no matter what position you take, the bottom line is that the sovereign God moved this people out when he wanted to. And now was the time for them to go. So this massive multitude of people leave Egypt. They get, they take their livestock, it says. And the rest of verse 39, much livestock, both flocks and herds. So they took their sheep and their goats and their camels and everything else that they had, and they left. And they took all of this stuff. So this is a lot of creatures, not just humans, but a lot of creatures walking out at this time. This is a massive, massive movement, a massive movement of people. Now, go down to chapter 13. The Lord said to Moses, consecrate to me all the firstborn. Whatever's the first to open the womb among the people of Israel, both of man and of beast, is mine. All right. Now, this is before the Exodus now. This is at the very beginning of the Exodus. This is what God says. Consecrate to me all of the firstborn. Now, what that, the word consecrate, of course, means to dedicate something to service, to set it apart. You consecrated elements of the temple in order to say these elements belong in the temple. They're to be used only in the temple. They're only to be used for worship. That's what consecration is. You consecrated a priest. You poured oil on him. You laid hands on him. You set him aside to the service of priesthood. He was now dedicated unto the Lord. His entire life was now for the Lord's use. So whether it's an object or a person, the idea is that you set it aside to the service of God, to make it an object of honor devoted to a sacred purpose. That's what consecration is. So God comes and says, now I want you to do this. I want you to consecrate to me all of the firstborn. Make it this to be mine. So what God is doing is laying claim on all of the firstborn humans and animals that are leaving in this 600,000 men. Everyone that's firstborn now belongs to me. Okay? Now, let me pause for a moment and point out what I did last week in the questions, is that God doesn't come along and take these to himself and make them only for the purpose of holy use. In other words, he doesn't turn them into priests. That will come later with the Levites. This is only symbolic. This is only symbolic. There's nothing in the text after this that would lead you to say that God took those firstborn and used them in some unique way in the history of Israel. There's nothing in the text would show that the firstborn Israelites who were walking out in the Exodus became somehow unique in the history of Israel in the future. So it has a symbolism. The symbolism, of course, is obvious. It's connecting itself back to what God did in the final plague in killing off the firstborn of Egypt. And so God is saying, listen, just as I took away the firstborn of Egypt and took them away because of the evil of Pharaoh and because of my glory, I am now taking, quote unquote, the firstborn of Israel to be mine. The firstborn belongs to me. All right, and this becomes symbolic as we move later. In verse 14 to 16, then, it explains why God does this. He says, and when in time to come your son asks you, what does this mean? You shall say to him, by a strong hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery. For when Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of animals. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord all the males that first opened the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. It shall be as a mark on your hand or frontlets between your eyes. For by a strong hand the Lord led us out of Egypt. So in other words, it's a symbol that is to be passed on to generation to generation. Tell this to your kids. This is what God did. Pass it on to the next generation that this is what God did, that he brought us out. And he did it in this way. He killed the firstborn of the house of Egypt. But the house of Israel, he redeemed, he spared, he made his own. Okay, see, that's where the symbolism goes. The symbolism is God saying, the firstborn of Egypt I'm destroying, but the firstborn of Israel I'm consecrating to myself. And the firstborn, you remember, often represents the idea in the Old Testament of a continuation of family line, right? The firstborn son becomes the great heir of the house. He's the one of great honor in the house. He's typically the one who gets all of the patriarchal privileges, that when the father dies, he then becomes the patriarch of the family and so on. That is carried on. And so God says, I'm setting aside the firstborn. Now, how many of you notice the contrast between this and the entire history of Israel up to this point? And the entire history of Israel at this point is that God had been passing over the firstborn time after time after time, right? He passed over the firstborn of Abraham. He passed over the firstborn of Isaac. And he will pass over the firstborn of Jacob in making Judah the primary tribe rather than Reuben or Simeon or Levi. So, in other words, God has said, although I passed over the firstborn in the past, I am now putting the firstborn in a place of prominence because it represents a continuation of my promise to you as a nation. Egypt destroyed as a nation. Killed off the firstborn, I destroyed them. Now I'm going to carry you on as a new nation by setting aside your firstborn unto me. And that's why I had you go look at John 10 and John 17. Because Jesus will link himself directly to this reality in the Exodus. And it would not have been lost on his readers or his hearers. Because remember, from the Israelite point of view, the firstborn was always considered the most important. So Jesus links himself here. In John 10, verse 30, starting in verse 30, he says, verse 29. My Father who has given them to me is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hand. I and the Father are one. Okay, so the first thing that he does is he declares himself by virtue of being the Son to being equal to the Father or one with the Father. Now, how do I know that Jesus meant that he was claiming divinity here? Because the very next sentence says the Jews picked up stones to stone him. They knew exactly what he was saying. They understood exactly what he was claiming, that he was one with God. So he's linking himself directly to the very nature and work of God by claiming both to be one with the Father here, and then over in John 17, when he prays to the Father, to be doing the work of the Father. Because in that great high priestly prayer, remember starting in verse 17, he says, sanctify them, that is the disciples, in the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world, and for their sake I consecrate myself, that they may also be sanctified in truth. I'm setting myself aside as the one doing your will in the world. So notice what he's doing. He's saying, I am both the one with the Father and consecrated to the Father because I'm the firstborn of the Father. Now, we discussed a little bit last week, you remember, in our discussions about this idea that in Orthodox Christian Trinitarian logic or theology, the Son is called the only begotten of the Father. And that phrase, coming out of the great ecumenical councils of the early centuries of the church, what it meant to those men is that at some time past, the Son proceeded out of the Father. Now, again, I can't explain how and when and sometime in eternity past, beyond the imaginations of humans caught in time, the Son was begat from the Father. Not born, of course, in the sense of a woman giving birth, but a sense begat, begotten from the Father. That's why we call him the only begotten of the Father. Some sense in which the Son comes from the Father. Now, I can't explain to you how that is. All I know is that this other person, which we call the Son, comes from the Father, but he bears the full nature of the Father, as he himself says. I and the Father are one. Okay, there's no distinction between us. The Jews understood that. And so he's claiming divinity. So he's claiming all the nature of God. Yet, he is the Son, and called the Son, because he is begot of the Father in some way. So here's the Son saying to his Father and about his Father, I am co-equal with the Father in every sense because I possess all the full nature of the Father, yet I'm the firstborn of God. I've come from God. So it's hard for us to get a grip on this idea because many in Christian orthodoxy simply assume that the Father and the Son have always been distinct. But that's not really Chalcedonian Christology. The idea of Chalcedonian Christology is that the Father and the Son were at one time one, and then the Son begat from the Father in some way. Now, again, don't put that in human terms and anthropomorphic ideas that the Son was born from the Father in some way in the past. No, it doesn't work. We don't really know how to explain it, except that they are of the same nature, yet they are of a Father-Son relationship. And that's why the Son can say, I've come to do the will of the Father, because I have come to subordinate myself to him. And so this picture of the consecrating the firstborn, Jesus picks up on and says, just like in that day when God blessed the people by setting aside the firstborn to himself, God is doing the same thing here. He is blessing a people by setting the firstborn of that people aside to himself, and the firstborn is the Son. And we're all in him. Remember that whole issue of the mystical union?
Yeah.
We're in him. If we're in him, in the mind of God, in eternity past, we come out of the Father in the Son. We're part of the firstborn as part of the mystical union. Okay? Now, not that many Christians today could care less about any of that sort of thing, but it's pointed to here. All right. Again, the symbolism is designed to point forward again, because I would argue that the entirety of the Old Testament is built around the idea of explaining who the seed is of Genesis 3:15. Who is the one, the seed of the woman, who will come to crush the head of the serpent? Well, what is the Old Testament designed to do? Flesh out who that person is. Okay, so here we have God saying to the Hebrew people, before you leave, consecrate those firstborn to me. They belong to me now. He never does anything with them per se. So it's obviously some sort of symbolic consecration. But why would he do it? Why would he say that? Because he's pointing forward to something about the seed. So now the seed is going to come, and he's the firstborn of the Father. He also, ironically, or not ironically, coincidentally, happens to be the firstborn of Mary and Joseph as well. So he becomes the firstborn of a human side of the equation as well as the divine side of the equation. So he's consecrated in that sense. So when he says the words consecrated here, he's linking himself back. For this sake, I consecrate myself. I set myself aside as your son.
So there had always been a son.
From our perspective, yes, there's always been a son. From God's perspective, no. From an eternity perspective, from an eternal perspective, the Son and the Father have always been one, yet they've always been distinct. Again, beget from both the Father and the Son. I will send my Spirit. Jesus says, okay, here's the tricky part. Jesus says, I will send my Spirit. And then other times he said, the Father will send the Spirit. And that, by the way, is the reason why the West embraced the filioque in the Apostles' Creed, where the East did not. Because the East insisted that the Spirit proceeded only from the Father. But the West said, nope, he proceeds from both the Father and the Son, because Jesus says he proceeds from me and from the Father. Don't ask me to explain it. I told you not to. I don't have an explanation. This is what God will reveal to us in eternity, I think, about the fullness of his nature as we'll understand this. But the symbolism here is designed to link this Jesus to this particular phrase, this consecration, in order to say, listen, just as I led a people out of slavery in Egypt, so my son, my firstborn son, is going to come and lead a people out of slavery someday as well. So it's pointing forward. Now, go to verse 17. When the Pharaoh let the people go, this is chapter 13. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of Philistines, although that was near. Okay, now let's do a little geography here. The land of the Philistines, if you remember, maybe you do, maybe you don't, you should. The land of the Philistines is located on the southeastern corner of the Mediterranean Sea. Egypt, as you remember, is just a bit lower on the southeastern corner. The Nile flows into the Mediterranean at the southeastern corner of the Mediterranean Sea. So the closest and fastest path back to Canaan would be a northeasterly route up from Goshen along the Mediterranean, and where would they have wound up? Nope. Right in the land of the Philistines. They would have had to go through the Philistines in order to get into Canaan.
Yeah.
So they would have had to go up, because they would have to avoid, see, they're trying to avoid the sea, The Red Sea, right? So there's a little narrow strip between the Red Sea and the Mediterranean, which now has a canal through it, okay? But that route there would have been up into Palestine, back into Palestine, but they'd have to go through Philistine territory to get up there. Okay, so God says, so when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest the people change their mind when they see war and return to Egypt. But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness towards the Red Sea. In other words, he took them in the wrong direction. On purpose. He took them south and east, which would have taken them down to the Red Sea at a point, you know, towards the Red Sea. And the people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle. I think what that means is they went up prepared to battle, equipped for battle, but they themselves didn't have the heart for battle yet. They had all the instruments of battle, right? They looted the Egyptians. They took a great deal of their military strength along with them, probably, but they didn't have a heart for it yet. So they went, and so that's why they go this way. So God leads them this way in order to avoid the resistance, but of course we know the real reason why he took them this way, because he wanted to lead them across the Red Sea into the Sinai Peninsula, and then the Egyptians would then perish in the sea behind them, and they would see that they would have a barrier then between them and Egypt from that point forward. Now, it says in verse 19 that they carried the bones. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and he shall carry up my bones with you from here. I think that the carrying of Joseph's bones are a tangible reminder that this Exodus was a part of God's overarching plan for his people from the time of Abraham forward. Because they were going to take the body of Joseph, what was left of him after 400 years, probably mummified, so there'd be a good part of him left. And they would take him back to Canaan and bury him at Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac and Sarah had all been buried. The idea is there's a continuity here. And we talked about this last week in the questions. Look, how much of this land that they were going back to did they own? And the answer, technically, none of it, except for the one field that Abraham bought. And he was very specific to buy that field. The Hittites said, I'll give it to you for free. Just take it and bury your dead. Abraham says, no, no, no. I want to purchase it. So now these descendants of Abraham, 600,000 men strong, can show up at Mamre, bury Joseph in that place, and they can say, oh, so we already do own some land. Here, we already do have a foothold in this place. And God will say to them, now remember when I told Abraham to walk around the land, all through the land and look, and everywhere he could see, everything that he could see was his? You do the same. Okay, so the carrying the bones of Joseph becomes a tangible reminder. They can look to this body that they're carrying and say, we're carrying that to bury it where our great ancestor Joseph was, our great ancestor Jacob was buried along with his father and grandfather, and we'll take Joseph back there and bury him. We'll go home. Let's go home. It's where we belong. It's where we came from. So it's where we belong. That's why they're doing it. That's why they're doing it. We see God leading them then with two visible manifestations, one of cloud and one of fire, according to verses 21 and 22. A pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. And you'll notice at the end of verse 21, it tells why, so that they could travel by day and night. Okay, remember, one of the first things that God said as part of the Passover is, put your traveling clothes on when you eat this meal because you're going out of here in haste. So they're hoofing it across this wilderness towards the Red Sea. So they're traveling by day and by night. That's what the fire's for, to move this massive crowd during the night. You got to have some sort of thing out there in the distance to follow. And so this pillar is going before them to lead them, and they're going fairly quickly. And of course, we know another reason why is because Pharaoh's about to change his mind. So you got 1.5 million to 2.5 million people going, let's get out of here, and let's get out of here now. We can't afford to stop and camp overnight somewhere along the way because Pharaoh will catch us. We need to go. So the pillar would be easy to follow. But there's another reason for the pillar of both cloud and fire, and that is it's a supernatural thing. I mean, have you ever seen a pillar of cloud lead a group of people across Baldwin County? I mean, seen tornadoes run across Baldwin County, but I mean, I've never seen a pillar of fire do it. Well, it has a supernatural reality to it. The people could look at that thing and say, hey, that's God out there in front of us, visibly manifesting himself. And by the way, which person of the Trinity is it? Think Trinitarian now, right?
Well, God reveals himself in the cloud.
Yeah. Which person of the Trinity is it? It's the Spirit of God.
Well, I've learned it's never the obvious answer.
It can't be the Father because, again, the Father's never visible. He never makes himself visible. Okay. The Son only appears in human form. That's his primary means. But the Spirit appears in tongues of fire, wind, all those other kinds of manifestations. So this is probably the third person of the Trinity leading ahead this group of people away. Always think of it that way. Never see the Father. Son always visible as human. Spirit always visible in other manifestations, other means. Fire and wind being his two favorite means. Fire and wind being his two favorite means. In fact, he's called Pneuma in the New Testament. Pneuma means wind. In fact, Jesus said in John 3, the wind, the pneuma, blows where it will. Well, most translations translate it as wind, but it really should be translated spirit. The Spirit blows where he wills. He goes where he wants, and
so
he goes where he wants.
The wind blew, it was the Spirit that was separated.
Correct. So now a pillar of cloud or a pillar of fire is probably the Spirit of the living God going before them to lead them away. So it's a supernatural manifestation. They would see the power of God. They would see these manifestations, and they would want to follow them. Or at least you would think so, right? Not necessarily. We'll see. Now, go to 14. The Lord said to Moses, tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of a place with a name too hard to pronounce, between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal Zephon. You shall encamp and face in it by the sea. Now God's still speaking when he says, for Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, they are wandering in the land, the wilderness has shut them in, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over them. It's almost as though you can see Pharaoh sit back and listen to his generals who come to him and say, they've turned to the south and to the east. They've blocked themselves in. Or as it appears in the movie, the Ten Commandments, the Pharaoh in the Ten Commandments says, the God of these Hebrews is a poor tactician. Poor general. Yep. He doesn't know which way he's going. Oh, he does. And he's, in a way, if you'll pardon my French, he's suckering Pharaoh in. He wants Pharaoh. Now, he's going to harden Pharaoh's heart, and he wants Pharaoh to chase him one last time in order to finally end this situation with him. And so his heart, once again, is hardened. And it says, and God says, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart. So God's, one last time, God is going to act in the heart of this man in order to cause him to turn against the Hebrews. He's let them go, but suddenly realizes, oh, that was a mistake. I shouldn't have done that. Now, again, I don't have to spend much time with this, but you see how short most human beings' memories are? I mean, he just lost his firstborn son, and God just killed off the firstborn of the entire nation, and yet he turns right around again and wants to go and get him back. Now, he's not the only one with short memories. The Israelites are short memory too. But nonetheless, notice this is the human condition. We're short memory. We're very short memory. Which is why God says you have to worship every Sunday, because you're going to forget. Okay? So they get to this place, and according to verse 11, or verse 10, it says, Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly. Well, rightly so. That's a good response, by the way. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. I don't remember them ever saying that. But apparently they think they did. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. Here's the people who have been enslaved for 400 years, who suddenly, all of a sudden, think, oh, it would have been better to be enslaved than to die here.
Well, we're saying that they could look and see a pillar of cloud or a pillar of fire.
Precisely. Precisely.
You're seeah, visible manifestation of God. Yeah. You're looking at
yeah.
You're saying that.
And you just saw him kill off, you know, a lot of people in Egypt, but you apparently don't remember that. We are a short-sighted lot, to say the least. Yeah. Oh, yes, right. But I think there's a lesson. I asked this as a question. What is the lesson in there for us? And that is, the lesson for us is that it's easy for us to forget the power of God as it has been demonstrated in our lives. And I'm not talking about some sort of healing power that God may have put upon you, or some financial thing or whatever. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the power of God to take you out of your sin and bring you to this Christ by faith and repentance. That's a miracle. It is. It is a resurrection act on the part of our God to take us out of that place of sin and death like Egypt and bring us out into the light. But we take that for granted, don't we? We just assume, yeah, I'm a Christian. I deserve to be one. I'm a Christian. Yeah, I'll go through the motions this week and, you know, just do what I got to do. And maybe I'll go to church. I don't know. I don't feel like it. Maybe I'll worship. I don't know. I don't feel like it. That's the human condition. Even as born-again Christians, even as men who have been regenerated by the Spirit of God, we still possess that fleshly nature of being short-sighted. These were people who had just seen the miracles of God, and they started whining over the fact that they were apparently trapped. But we very much feel the same way. I mean, what's our first reaction when we get bad news? Right? I mean, what's our first reaction when we get bad news? Why did God do this to me? Why do I blah, 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 blah? I mean, I'm guilty of this. I admit it. I'm just as guilty as anyone. The first reaction to something going wrong is to pitch a fit and to whine and to carry on. And, oh, there should have been graves in Egypt for us to die in rather than out here. That's what we do. So what do we need? We need a constant and consistent reminder of what it is that our God has done for us. This is what sets genuine Christianity apart from all other religions, that God has done something spectacular for us, and we should be grateful, humble, worshipful people. We should be on our face constantly before this God saying, I don't deserve this, and if you decide to take it away from me, you have perfect right to do that. Now, we know he won't, but nonetheless. So, you know, we like to look at these Egyptians and go, I wouldn't have said that when I was there. Uh-uh. You probably would have. We forget the power of the cross so easily, don't we? And let me also suggest another time that we forget the power of the cross. We forget the power of the cross when we find ourselves ashamed of what we have done. We forget the power of the cross when we find ourselves ashamed of something we've done. You feel ashamed anytime this week? Don't answer that. Was there some time this week when you thought to yourself, oh, there I go again, falling under the temptation, and you feel that shame? And our natural reaction is to go, no, God must hate me again. I must be off. We lose track of the power of the cross, because in those moments, what we really should be saying is, yes, I'm a sinner, worthless, but that Christ has paid for that sin, and I'm going to stand firm at the foot of the cross and look into the face of this Christ and know that he has saved me from this sin. Our assurance of salvation is not found in our behavior or the success of our behavior. It's found only in what he did. And so that's another of our short-sightedness. So next week, when you're feeling a little shame for something you've done, turn and look at that cross and say, what did he do?
We're going to do it, Raheem, right? It's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And you also can ask for forgiveness.
Of course. Of course, absolutely. You should.
Which is?
Precisely. I go to this Father. Father.
Don't change it, even though you're going to do it again.
Right.
Most likely.
Probably.
You know.
Highly likely. But here's what the problem is. There's a lot of Christians or people who are immature in their faith. Look, I get a lot of them coming to my office, and they say, well, I'm not really sure I'm a Christian. I mean, look at my life. Look at what I've done. Look at my past. Look at what I'm, I don't know this. I don't know that. And I'm having to say, wait a minute. Wait. Our assurance is found in a simple reality that Jesus walked out of that tomb on that Sunday morning. Do you believe that? If you believe that's true, then everything else he said must be true. Because he's the only guy I've ever known of who actually said he was going to rise from the dead and then did. Okay, so there's our assurance. Our assurance is not being so short-sighted about forgetting the very things that make us assured. You're right, David. We absolutely should be at first onto our face, humble before this God. I have sinned. Right. But what many will do is go off the track at that point. That's where apostasy comes from.
I've gotten to talk to my kids a lot. Here lately. I'm getting there. Not there yet. But, you know, like I keep telling them, I said, just come right here and read this.
Mm-hmm.
Read it.
Yeah.
And then tell me different.
Right.
Tell me why I'm a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's getting there.
Good. Very good.
I don't get there, but it's
well,
getting there.
Only the Lord and only the Spirit of God can change that, so you leave it in His hands.
It's really hard to deal with them, you know, when they go into another church.
I understand. That's fine. You tell them the truth.
I learned through all up here to agree to disagree with them. Without making them upset.
Right.
They had the constant presence of the Spirit of God in the pillar cloud and fire, and we have the indwelling Holy Spirit.
Right.
Even in spite of having the dwelling Spirit in us, we still forget.
And we've seen the miracles of God, and so on. See, I couldn't. Again, this is another one of those examples, Les, we were talking about the other day about how, you know, Mr. Stanley couldn't be more wrong in that we have to disconnect ourselves from the Old Testament. You can't understand Christ without understanding what it is that this, what has happened here. These are not just stories of historical import. These are things designed to point us to the Christ. So we look at these people and we go, sad that they are so quick to jump off ship when they get to a problem and then go, oh, wait a minute. That's me. Right? That's the intention, okay? So now go to verse 13 where it says, and Moses said to the people, okay, they're standing at the sea now, fear not, stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians who you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you and you have only to be silent. Now compare that to verse 30. And down in verse 30 it says, thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. The bodies washed ashore is what that means. And they saw the dead bodies of the Egyptians in the sea. But what's the point? The walk through the Red Sea was designed to strengthen the faith of the Israelites in his God, in their God. Obviously, it was to show his power too, right? He could part the sea, and the people would walk through on dry land, and then the chariots would run in, the water would come back over them and kill them all off. The bodies would wash up on the shore, and they'd be on the other side. And they didn't have to raise one sword; they didn't have to get one chariot managed. Moses didn't have to become a general leading the people to fight against the Egyptians. Although they were prepared for battle, they were not prepared for battle. So God said, "Just be quiet." And let me do what I'm going to do. So, yes, it shows the power of God, but it's also designed to put a barrier now between them and their past. The Red Sea closing in over the Egyptians seals their safe passage to the other side. So now Egypt is on the other side of the sea. Well, that's what God has done for us. God says, sit down, be quiet, and I will fight for you. So this Christ comes in your place, goes to the cross, and he fights the devil on your behalf, and he wins. And all you have to do is be silent. All you have to do is say, okay, that's mine. That's all. See? We don't fight against the devil to win our salvation. He fought against the devil. And now he creates a Red Sea between us and the devil, because he himself has said, all that the Father gives me will come to me and I will lose none of them. There won't be any dead Christian bodies coming up on the shore of the sea. Nope. The only bodies that are going to be in the water are going to be the enemy. The enemy is going to drown. I'm going to kill the enemy. You cannot help but notice the parallels here, can you? You cannot help but see the parallels between what it is that God is doing here with what God is going to do in Christ. He is going to send his son, who's going to lead a people through the valley to the place of peace. Right? Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. Why? Because God is on my side. Because this Christ has come and specifically accomplished this. For the Hebrews, their time in Egypt is closed by the Red Sea incident, and they're now able to look forward to the promised land. Now, looking back now, only looking forward. And I can't help but see another parallel. And this one is a strong one that you see in 1 Corinthians 10. Paul, of course, as a good Hebrew, would have known this parallel all of his life. It didn't become something important to him until after he was converted, but he would have seen this parallel. In chapter 10, Paul actually refers to this event. Okay, so 1 Corinthians 10 says, "For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud." What cloud? Well, the cloud that was leading them. "And all passed through the sea." Now catch this phrase. "And all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them." Of course, that's later after the... But he starts the chapter with this idea. He says, let me show you another symbolism here. And the symbolism is the symbolism of baptism. As the Israelites, the Hebrews, I should say, go through the Red Sea, they are baptized. Notice they're going through water here. Don't catch the irony of that. They're going through water, and they're walking through water, and when they get to the other side, the water closes in. They've come out from the water on the other side. They come out dry, but they come out nonetheless. And Paul says they were being baptized. A new life has now come. The old life is gone. And this is the picture of baptism that's painted in the New Testament, isn't it? What is baptism? Contra our paedo-baptist friends, what baptism is a testimony in which we stand before the world and say, I used to live in that world, but I have died to that world and been buried from that world. Now I've been raised to walk in a new world, a new way of life. So for the Hebrews, they were now done with Egypt. They weren't going to go back, and they never did. You'll notice they never went back. The people of Israel were never conquered by the Egyptians. They were never subservient to the Egyptians, although the Egyptians did have some military effect upon them as a nation. But generally speaking, Egypt really is not heard from again in the story of Israel. That's in their past, and the same is true with us. When we stand in those waters and we say before the world, I'm being buried with this Christ in baptism and raised to walk a new life, we are saying, I'm putting that old life behind me. It's done. I am being consecrated unto the Lord. I'm being consecrated unto the Lord. I'm going through this. So Paul himself, now this, of course, this, Paul says in verse 6, now these things took place as examples for us that we might not desire evil as they did. And he goes on to talk about how we should not be what we were before. We should not be what we were before. Now, again, what's going on in the church today, unfortunately, and I don't mean to harp upon this, but what you're getting in the church now is a lot of people coming into the church and saying, listen, I'm a Christian, but I'm also homosexual. And those two things can coexist in their mind. It's possible to be a gay Christian. And so the church is supposed to say, yes, you can be that and be a Christian at the same time. But what Paul will write in this book very clearly is, no, you were that, you can no longer be that. So there's no room in Christianity for gay Christian. Now, you will hear that term used a lot. And I'm telling you, over the next 5 years, you will get sick of hearing that term because it's going to be pummeled at us through every imaginable source, okay? We can be a gay Christian, and we should be celebrating homosexuality in the church because God made people this way. And Paul would say, wait a minute, yeah, maybe he did make you this way, but when you come to Christ, that's what you used to be. The old life has been crucified and buried. Now it's time for a new one.
But he loves you just the way you are.
Well, yeah, but see, that's false.
That's a lie.
That's a lie. He does not like you the way, does not love you the way you are. He hates sin. And according to, I forget the passage, he hates the sinner too. And so the fact of the matter is that Psalm 5 is where I was going. He hates the sinner as well as the sin. See, we always say, well, just, you know, hate the sin, love the sinner. But God says, no, I hate the sinner too. Why? Because the sinner hates me. The sinner hates me. The sinner doesn't love me. So the man who walks into the church saying, I want to keep sinning the way I used to sin, but yet you call me a Christian, doesn't understand what Paul's talking about here. Has never got it. Nope. We walk through the sea. We see closes in. There's no going back. Thus, we cannot whine about what we used to be. We must just move forward from here, which is exactly what the Israelites are doing. Again, notice the parallels.
It's hard to understand that he chose before the foundation of the world. And when he chose you, he hated you.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had not been born, you
were
born a sinner.
Right.
So he chose you, yet he hated you.
We call that grace.
And when did he start loving you?
When he sent his spirit to take out that heart of stone.
Up to that point.
You are, unfortunately, you're doing a little anthropomorphizing of God there, okay, because God can love and hate simultaneously. You can't, but he can. He loved you with an everlasting love, it says, because you were in Christ, and yet he hates the sinner at the same time. So you got to hold those two thoughts in tension. But here's the good news. For those he loves, even though he hated you as a sinner, he loved you and kept you until he saved you and holds you fast to himself for all eternity. And that's out of his love.
Okay.
Yep.
While we were yet sinners, Christ died.
Right. While we were yet haters of God, Christ died for us. Right. So, yeah, we hated God, but yet he still loved us. And yet at the same time, he hated the sinner. Now, hate from God's perspective is different from hate from our perspective. That's another thing to keep in mind, right? Hate is a rejection more than it is a emotion. We treat it as an emotion because we don't know any better. But he can treat it as more than that. And we can't truly understand how God emotes and feels and understands things because we're not God. So when God says, I hated you as a sinner, yet I loved you enough to save you, you have to hold those two things in tension and say those things must both be true.
We need to read on a little bit farther the reason he did it in Ephesians.
In Ephesians.
For his glory.
For his glory, of course. Right. It's not about us. It's never been about us.
You should have stayed where you were.
Right. You should have. I should have left you there. In fact, if I'd have been doing what my nature demanded of me, I would have left you there. And most people he does. He just leaves them. Although he will bring a innumerable measure of many to himself. More than we can count. But then again, I can't count to a billion anyway, so a billion people would be a lot, right? So this lesson is more than just about some people crossing the Red Sea. Yeah, I know that's kind of the way the story goes. But you'll notice I really didn't focus terribly much on the crossing itself and sort of the children's details. But I wanted you to catch the larger symbolism of what's going on here. God is taking a people out of a place of slavery, consecrating the firstborn in contrast to the firstborn that he killed, and sending them in the wrong direction purposely so that Pharaoh would come after him again, but now using that in order to bring them across a physical, in their case, a physical barrier that would separate them permanently from their place of sin. So the worst whining is yet to come, because when they're across the sea and now in the Sinai wilderness and complaining about the fact that there's no water and there's no food, what does God say to them? Listen, I took you out of there. In fact, that becomes the first phrase of the Decalogue. You remember? The very first phrase of the Ten Commandments is, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. That becomes the foundational basis upon the relationship these people have with him. I put the barrier between them and you for all eternity. And that's exactly what he says to us. There's the parallels. He says, you belong to me now. You don't belong to the world anymore. I've put the barrier up between the two of you. So the seed, The seed of the woman comes to destroy that which came to destroy us. And God has now put a barrier between us and him in this Christ. And that barrier is his blood. I've often wondered if there's any symbolism in the term red, in the fact that this is the Red Sea. I don't think so, because it's an ancient word, and I don't think it means red in its original form. I think that's more of a Anglicized word. So I'm not sure of that. I don't think so. I'm not going to make any connection there, but it just seems ironic to me that we call it the Red Sea, because we have to pass through a Red Sea as well. And it's the blood of Christ that we pass through. Just speculating on that one, though. That one's way out there on the limb. That one's way out there on the limb. Yeah. It sounds cool, though, doesn't it? Yeah. All right. There's questions for next week. We're going to do a two-part series on the wandering in the wilderness up to Sinai before we get to Exodus 20, because we have enough material to do two lessons on that. So you'll have part one of it coming up for next week. So